From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world was shocked as American journalist James Foley was beheaded, with all signs pointing to a British ISIS operative. ISIS is recruiting and attracting Europeans and Americans, young men, young women, to be fighters and sleeper cells. This hour on Point, Westerners joining radical Islamic movements. Who are they? Why are they? And what could it mean for the rest of us? You can join us on air or online. Are you shocked that American citizens, Europeans, are joining ranks with ISIS? Do you understand the pull? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from London is Peter Newman. He's the director of the International Center for the Study of Radicalization, where he's been tracking Westerners traveling to Syria to join the fight. He's a professor of security studies at King's College London and author of the book Old and New Terrorism. Peter Newman, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
So the British ambassador to the United States says investigators are close to identifying that young British militant who beheaded the American journalist James Foley. Let's listen to him. Here he is, the masked ISIS fighter just before the beheading.
Any aggression towards the Islamic State is an aggression towards Muslims from all walks of life who have accepted the Islamic Caliphate as their leadership. So any attempt by you, Obama, to deny the Muslims their rights of living in safety under the Islamic Caliphate will result in the bloodshed of your people.
Peter, what's the latest on this investigation from London?
So I think they're pretty close to knowing who it is. And that's not surprising in a sense, because a lot of the foreign fighters, despite being in Syria, are still active on social media. They still have Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts. They're on Instagram. They're using WhatsApp and Skype. So they are not entirely unknown to the intelligence services. So they will analyze pictures for likenesses. They will have looked at that person's fingernails, his height, his build. And of course, after the publication of the video, they will have listened very carefully to what these foreign fighters are talking to each other about, because it only takes one of them to let slip the identity of the person in order for him to be identified. Mm. I think they're pretty close. Mm.
Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron responding to the beheading of James Foley by the man with the British accent.
We know that far too many British citizens have travelled to Iraq and travelled to Syria to take part in extremism and violence. And what we must do is redouble all our efforts to stop people going, to take away the passports of those contemplating travel, to arrest and prosecute those that take part in this extremism and violence, to take extremist material off the internet, and do everything we can to keep our people safe.
Peter Newman, talk to us about this foreign fighter phenomenon. How many foreign fighters have joined the ranks of ISIS in places like Syria and Iraq?
So we think that over the past 3 years, up to 12,000 people have gone from foreign countries into Syria and now Iraq as foreign fighters. 74 nations we've counted as being represented. But 20%, most of them are from the Middle East, but about 20-25% of them, maybe 2,500, are from Western countries. And most of those who are from Western countries are from Europe. In fact, Britain is not the most heavily affected country, even though 3 to 4, maybe a little bit more, have gone from Britain. There are other countries like France, for example, which have provided 700 foreign fighters, Belgium 500, Scandinavian countries. So there has been a sizable number of Europeans who have gone to Syria.
Mm. What's the motivation of these foreign fighters? Why are they joining the jihadist movement?
I think there's a combination of things going on. On the one hand, there is a personal appeal. It's about adventure, brotherhood. It's about fighting, about going there, potentially becoming a hero. But there's also a serious political, religious message that comes out there. On the one hand, it's about saying, you know, there's a genocide going on of the Sunni Muslim people of Syria. Your brothers and sisters are being killed, tortured, and raped. You have to come to their rescue. This is the time in history where you have to step up and show what you believe in and rescue your brothers and sisters. On the other hand, since June, of course, we've had this idea of the Islamic State, which is a very exciting historical project. So people are being told in 1,000 years' time, people are going to speak about the young Western Western guys who came to build the new caliphate. So both on the negative and the positive side, they're very appealing messages.
So be a part of history, so to speak. But is the goal then generally to regain the region, build this new caliphate, institute Sharia law? Is that sort of the headline goal?
That is the goal for ISIS. I think some of the foot soldiers may be not seeing the big picture as such. I think they are excited about becoming meaningful and having a sense of purpose in their life and being part of a big historical project.
So compared to jihadists 10 to 15 years ago, there is greater cultural and ethnic diversity now. Really a lot of young people, right? Peter, men and women. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you really struggled to find a woman in some of these groups.
Yes. So we've been at my institute at ICSR, we've been monitoring these guys for almost 2 years. We built up a database with 500 profiles of foreign fighters, and we're seeing a lot more young people, 15, 16 year olds. We're also seeing a lot of women, which is very unusual. 10, 15 years ago, when you looked at homegrown extremists, you would struggle to find any females involved. But I think the internet has made it possible for females to become involved without having face-to-face meetings, and you see a lot of women, maybe 10-15% in some European countries, wanting to go to Syria and get married to fighters and support ISIS.
You said earlier 10-15% of these foreign fighters come from Western countries. Here's British ambassador to the U.S. Peter Westmacott speaking on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday about the threat of UK citizens joining ISIS.
We think that there's probably as many as 500 people from the United Kingdom have gone to join jihad, gone to join ISIS. And so we are focusing our efforts across the board on how to counter this terrible threat, which is, as my foreign secretary was saying in an op-ed this morning, a betrayal of all that we stand for. And I might add, a betrayal of everything, frankly, that the teachings of the Prophet stand for, as the leaders of the Muslim communities in the United Kingdom have been very clear about.
Peter Newman is my guest this hour, director of the International Center for the Study of Radicalization. I'd like to bring in another voice now to the conversation. Patrick Skinner joins me from Savannah, Georgia. He's an expert on ISIS and al-Qaeda, a former CIA case officer. He's currently the director of special projects for the Soufan Group, which provides security intelligence to government and multinational corporations. Patrick, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
So talk to us about ISIS. How is ISIS different from other jihadi groups we've seen before?
Well, in one way, they're very similar, at least their ideology. It's a violent Wahhabist, Takfiri, virulent strain of Sunni Islam. And so superficially, they're very, very similar. They're all very extremely violent and savage. But in another way, they're unique. And most of that, some of it's good planning and organizational on their part, and then they're also a creature of the circumstances. Between Iraq and Syria has been the perfect petri dish to kind of breed this environment.
So how is ISIS different than from al-Qaeda, if this is the perfect petri dish? I mean, we often hear that ISIS was the group that got kicked out of al-Qaeda because it was so extreme. But that's not necessarily what happened. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, yes. Al-Qaeda Central, meaning bin Laden back then and now Zawahiri now, sure, they cautioned them, or the predecessor group, to kind of tone down the optics. Now, they don't object to killing. It's important to note that. They're just objected to the optics. They thought it was bad PR. And so they're not too savage for al-Qaeda. They just weren't public relations savvy enough. But then, by the end, the split was more about doctrine and allegiance. The Baghdadi's group, al-Qaeda in Iraq or ISIS now, they just simply did not need al-Qaeda.
Peter Newman, you talked about 12,000 of these foreign fighters now in the Middle East, 74 nations represented. How are these fighters being recruited, Peter?
Through various different means. In Europe, for example, we see clusters of people going, people who've previously been involved in extremist organizations and who are going on the basis of that. On the other hand, you do have people who are finding stuff on the internet, who are just showing up on the border with Turkey and are offering themselves. So there's not a general profile of recruitment. It happens through all sorts of channels. And that is really what is unique about this particular conflict. There's never been so many opportunities to join up. Maybe in the past, people were motivated, but they found it difficult to go to places like Somalia, Afghanistan. Now it is so easy to buy a budget airline ticket to Turkey and to go into Syria. And a lot of people are doing it.
Well, and the internet, too. You talked about tracking them through social media. I mean, the internet has made this so much easier. How to travel, what to bring, you know, which would have been impossible 20 years ago.
This is the first conflict in which it is actually possible for wannabe foreign fighters to speak to actual foreign fighters. We see that every day in our monitoring on websites like Ask.fm, but also on Twitter, where people find it very easy to get in touch with actual foreign fighters and to ask them, what should I wear? What should I bring? Do I need to bring money? How do I go there? The logistics of it are a lot easier than they were even 10 years ago in Iraq.
Yes, I'm reading about videos distributed by some of these groups. They've got their own YouTube accounts. I mean, the message spreading as far as the West through social media, as you say, Twitter, Facebook, even Instagram.
Absolutely. And so I think this is the most socially mediated conflict that we've ever seen. And this is perhaps a sign of things to come.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the trend of Europeans and Americans leaving their homes to join groups like ISIS in the Middle East. We're joined this hour by Peter Newman in London, director of the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College London. And Patrick Skinner joins me from Savannah, Georgia. He's an expert on ISIS and al-Qaeda and is director of special projects for the Sufan group. We're trying to clear up Patrick's connection at the moment, but let me play some sound here from last Thursday when Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said that ISIS is more than just a terror organization and that the U.S. may have to deal with it for a long time.
Oh, this is beyond anything that we've seen. So we must prepare for everything. And the only way you do that is you take a cold, steely, hard look at it and get ready.
Peter Newman, just in January, President Obama likened ISIS to a, quote, JV team. And now you hear the defense secretary say that they are beyond anything we have seen. I'm curious, what's changed?
So ISIS has, I think ISIS has been a surprise to a lot of people. I think the president and the defense secretary are reflecting what their intelligence community has told them. And even a year ago, the consensus was that there is a number of extremist groups out there in Syria. All of them are pretty powerful, but no one, including myself, not a lot of experts predicted that ISIS would advance as quickly and as powerfully as they have done. So this came as a surprise to a lot of experts, including myself, and probably also as a surprise to the intelligence community in the U.S.
Is it the military might? Is it their money? Is it their branding? Why?
I think what differentiates ISIS from al-Qaeda is this different strategy, which is about starting a state, not wanting to overthrow a regime, but start a state, even if it's really small, and then expand it. And of course, if you start a state, if you occupy territory, you have income, you can tax people, you can seize military vehicles, you can start building a conventional army. And that has proven to be a very powerful strategy that al-Qaeda didn't try in the past. And that really has surprised a lot of people.
Let's get a listener in on this from Omaha, Nebraska. Jared is on the line. Hi, Jared. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Fine. Go ahead.
I have two questions, if you don't mind. One is, I guess for your guests, how do we defeat this fundamentalist extremism as they receive aid from new recruits from the West and as their children are indoctrinated into this group? I mean, these kids grew up with pictures of suicide bombers on their walls. I recently saw a militant on Al Jazeera talking about how their jihad is loftier, how they're not seeking any kind of truce with the U.S. with Western powers if they get everything they're hoping for. What happens if they get or come into control of nuclear weapons? Do you think they'll use them, or will there be a standoff?
Jared, thank you. Patrick Skinner, I believe we have you back here. Thanks for sticking with us. Answer Jared's questions here. First, defeating this fundamentalist extremism. How do you go about doing that?
But it's exceedingly difficult to fight an ideology. And at the root of it, it's a violent ideology. And it's born from, you know, a perversion of a religion, but also from very bad circumstances. So to truly combat it would require decades of building, you know, bureaucracies. In America and the West, bureaucracy has a bad name. But a functioning government is, or a bureaucracy, is a really good thing if you don't have one. And so there's so many things, social services. There has to be unemployment. The unemployment rates for the youth are 50% for the target male audience across the region. And so, yes, we'd have to fight them militarily right now because it's a military fight. But the answer is going to be much longer. And that's why nothing has really been done. It's very difficult to change an entire region.
And Peter Newman, to Jared's second point, what happens if ISIS gets its hands on nuclear weapons?
Personally, I don't think I cannot conceive any scenario as to how they should. I do not think they can develop any nuclear weapons. I do not think any state would give them nuclear weapons. So I do think that is a very low probability scenario, not something that we should discount entirely, but I don't think it is likely to happen anytime soon.
Here's John in Oklahoma City. John, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah. So my point and question is that I understand these are young people, and also what I understand is they don't most of them don't even speak Arabic, and so I wonder where they're getting their information from, where they're being told that they're freedom fighters, and I wonder if it's the mosques that they're getting this information from. But also I'd like to add that, you know, in Christian churches we have mission trips. Are these like mission trips for them?
John, thank you. Patrick Skinner, would you respond?
Yes. Well, ISIS and most jihadist groups are pretty adept at having multi-language social media platforms. ISIS has made a big push to do English language, and also some Bahasa Indonesia, Nigerian, Dutch, and so they're really good at it. Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda spinoff and failed partnership, they're primarily Arabic, their appeal. They haven't really broadened too much. But ISIS really does focus on the West. Now, if you travel there, you're going to probably speak some level of Arabic, or you're going to be put into a foreign fighter cell where there might be a translator. So the language barrier is not a problem. If you're inclined to look for that information or feel some kind of attraction to it, it is everywhere. Mm. You can find it very easily. It's no longer these chat rooms. It's now just Twitter, and it's impossible to block these accounts. Mm.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation here. Humira Khan joins me from Washington. She's the executive director of Mufulhoon, an organization that works in Muslim countries to prevent radicalization and counter violent extremism. She has advised the U.S. government and law enforcement agencies in several European countries. And in 2012, she received the FBI Director's Community Leadership Award for her work. Humira, nice to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Jane, thank you for having me.
So what are you seeing in terms of radicalization in America's Muslim youth?
We're seeing, again, the numbers which we have for going into ISIS are, the numbers are somewhere between 100 and 200 that we know of, are which have gone to Syria or Iraq to join ISIS, and also Jabhat al-Nusra. In terms of actual numbers, over time, again, we've seen about 200 cases of people affiliated with al-Qaeda type or indicted for al-Qaeda type terrorism over the past 12 years. And then since the coming up, the past 3 years, we're seeing there's almost between 100 and 200 people. So again, so the numbers are there. We're not seeing the same numbers as Europe is seeing, for sure. Mm-hmm. And part of it is obviously access. Part of it is that our environment and how we are living and the social context and the cultural context is different in the U.S. So some of the same factors apply, but others don't.
So what does make someone susceptible, given those factors? What makes someone susceptible to recruitment?
Okay, so disclaimer up front is that there is no actual real, like, no specific profile, right? So people will join, and just like Peter mentioned earlier, people join for personal reasons. Some join for, you know, the context, the cultural reasons. There's some people who are there because they are very interested. They want to fight oppression, right? Others are there because they are looking to belong. They're looking for status. Some of them actually feel it's cool. So it's a spectrum of reasons which are happening. What we're seeing is that, again, and this is true for not just ISIS, but also recruitment to all, you know, Al-Qaeda as well, or Al-Qaeda affiliates, mm-hmm. is that isn't causality, and it's a non-linear process. What we do know is that, you know, while some might join because they are looking for belonging, others might join because they have family members in there. Mm-hmm. We do know that certain things that we are seeing, the factors which increase the propensity towards violence are the same across many different crimes. We do know that the age of people who are being targeted is actually younger. What this means is that because some of them are younger, they actually don't know the difference between right and wrong to start off with. And so when they actually fed something different or something wrong, they actually don't even have the filters yet to process that what they're being given is wrong information. Mm.
So, Peter, pick up on that a little bit. That's what Humira is seeing in the United States. I mean, I'm reading stories here across the board of young people going off to school one day, never coming home, kids sneaking out of the house in the middle of the night, their parents wondering where they went, they're headed for Syria. I mean, this is real stuff. This is happening, you know, around the world, Peter. What is there something in these home countries that pushes them away, that motivates their radicalization, that's different from what's happening here?
Yes, of course. I do think the beginning of the story is always that people do not feel that they belong. I think there needs to be a sense of being detached from your home society. And that's perhaps also one of the reasons why you see comparatively fewer recruits from the United States than from a lot of European countries, because in a lot of European countries, we do have Muslim populations that are very badly integrated, that have not embraced the civic virtues of our countries in the same way that American Muslims, for example, have by and large embraced the American dream. And these people do not feel they belong. It is being comparatively easier for them to just go somewhere else based on a transnational ideology and even kill people that would be almost like you.
We've been talking about these younger militants. Here's some sound from the uncle of a British suicide bomber named Abdul Majid, who was 41 years old. He was the father of three. He told his family that he was a humanitarian worker in Syria. Instead, he had joined ISIS and in early February blew up a truck bomb as part of an assault on an Aleppo prison.
He was a good family man, you know. He had his head in right place, you know, and we never thought he was linked to anybody other than, you know, his family.
Here's Andrew, another caller from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling about a kind of disturbing trend I see. I'm 21 years old, and my whole life, it seems to me that I've been told that Islamic fundamentalists are a plane ticket away. And that seems to me to be a very direct echo of 9/11. And so I'm wondering if how to see through the kind of perpetual newness and fear-mongering that I think is going on in the media right now. How do we deal with that? And how do we deal with the fact that, like it or not, selling ISIS as a major immediate threat seems to me to be a justification for what seems to be a financial and military commitment to going back into Iraq. How do we see through what is actually different, and how do we cope with the fact that, you know, it seems to me that people have always been a plane ride away?
Andrew, thank you. Thank you very much. Peter Newman.
Well, I disagree. I think that if you know the current American president, you know that he was running his whole campaign in 2008 on the promise of not going back into Iraq. So this whole idea that this is some sort of plot to get back into Iraq doesn't make sense. President Obama does not want to go back into Iraq. But there's a situation right now which is probably surprising him as much as it is a surprise to everyone else, which is very unfortunate, and which not in the short term, but in the medium and long term, could be a threat to the West and to the American homeland. Not because these guys are going to attack America tomorrow, but because they are providing the sort of safe haven and sanctuary that existed in Afghanistan before 9/11 and that was instrumental in creating the basis for 9/11. So there is a threat, not in the short term, but in the medium and long term. It is not something that is constructed. It is not a conspiracy theory. It is real, and unfortunately, we have to deal with it.
Patrick Skinner, respond to John. How do you see it?
Yeah, I fully agree. I usually downplay most threats. Even in my old job, you could see that some things were inflated, not on purpose, but just because it's frightening or because it's new or because the facts on the ground are very uncertain. But this is one of the times where the threat is, at least among the rational people, it's not overblown. This is a serious threat. Is it an existential threat to America? No, but right now it is certainly an existential threat to Syria and Iraq. And now you can throw out, is ISIS going to get a nuclear weapon? No, they're not. But they have sanctuary. And as Peter said, sanctuary, and they're treating Syria like an ATM bank machine. They're getting $1 million a day, even on the low estimates. Mm. And they have, training grounds. And they have all this experience. And now they have a lot of weapons. So this is something that I'm a non-interventionist. I really believe that most things are made worse when you intervene directly with military. This is not one of those cases. This is something that it is collapsing, and you have to do something.
Patrick, talk more about the money behind ISIS. Where is it coming from? You say Syria is acting as an ATM machine. I mean, what's fueling their revenues beyond that?
Well, what's fueling it, in some cases, is actual fuel. They've seized some functioning oil wells in Syria and small refinery places outside of Beji in Iraq. And so they are a non-OPEC oil-producing organization, maybe estimates up to 100,000 barrels a day. Now, they're not getting fair market price, $95 a barrel, because it's on the black market. But they're selling it through to Turkey, some through Kurdistan, and then Syria. They're selling it to the locals who need it, and then who will resell it on the open market, or they sell it to the Assad regime. And so that's only one thing. Then they make millions of dollars with ransom. They make millions more with extortion. Say you have your mobile cellular company in Syria. You have the towers. They will just let you know, hey, $50,000 a month, or we're going to blow up your mobile tower and collapse your business. Mm. Everyone's going to pay. They're doing the standard, everything that moves in and out of the supply routes, which is what they've strategically taken, they tax. They extort the drivers. They robbed. They actually took $4 million in antiquities early on. And so they're a full-service, self-sustaining organization right now, which is why sanctions don't work. They're not a state actor. Sanctions are not going to work. And something has to be done. They have a lot of money.
Peter Newman, do the finances of this make ISIS more dangerous?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what makes them so powerful and so aggressive at the same time, because they are the de facto state power. We call it extortion. Other people call it tax. They are doing the same things that a state would normally do, a legitimate state would normally do in its territory. It is charging people for providing services, and that guarantees their income. They are no longer reliant so much on donations from the Gulf state and from illegal income. They are self-sustaining, and that makes them a particular threat.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashberg, we're talking this hour about Islamic fighters from foreign countries, America, England, and many other European countries. We're joined this hour by Peter Newman in London, director of the International Center for the Study of Radicalization at King's College London. Patrick Skinner joins me from Savannah, Georgia. He's an expert on ISIS and al-Qaeda and is director of special projects for the Soufan Group. And from Washington, Humira Khan, executive director of Mufflehoon, a group that works with Muslim communities to prevent radicalization. Here's some sound. Actually, this is a video produced by the Islamic extremist group Al-Nusra Front, showing a bearded American man burning his American passport and then speaking into a camera.
"We are coming for you. Mark my words. Listen to my words, you big kuffar. You think, oh, that you killed Osama bin Laden. You did nothing. You sent him to Jannah, alhamdulillah. You sent him to paradise. You think that you have won? You have never won."
And here is Congressman Mike Rogers, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, speaking on Meet the Press yesterday about the threat of ISIS.
One of the problems is it's gone unabated for nearly 2 years, and that draws people from Britain to across Europe, even the United States, to go and join the fight. They see that as a winning ideology, a winning strategy, and they want to be a part of it. And that's what makes it so dangerous. They are one plane ticket away from U.S. shores, and that's why we're so concerned about it.
Let's go back to the phones. Hassan is calling from Seattle, Washington. Hassan, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you for having me on.
You bet.
I've been listening to your guest, and shared some great information. I do want to point out to the 100-pound Wahhabi elephant that's in the room, which is Saudi Arabia. I know that people have defended them in the past, saying that, well, the Saudis are just worried about ISIS just as much as everyone else. The only reason Saudi's worried about the ISIS is if they're coming to their border. If they're staying out, they're causing chaos in Syria, Iraq, Pakistan, wherever else. They have no issues with that. People will say that the Saudis just gave $100 million donation to the United Nations to fight terrorism, but that's just blood money that United Nations continues to accept from the Saudis. The United States itself has turned the other cheek by accepting Saudi blood money in the form of, buying $60 billion worth of weapons, all sorts of, airplane deals and whatnot. We can point to ISIS's, economic power now with gas and what the guest just mentioned. But at the same time, this happens more than just social media and Facebook as far as attracting people over there. There's things going on in Madrasa, especially in the UK, where we know that the Wahhabi movement is out in the open. These guys are out in the streets. They don't make any, they're not shy about it. And, somehow we're downplaying the role which Saudi Arabia has on madrasas worldwide, not just in UK, not just in Pakistan and other countries. And even some here in the United States, maybe not as potent. As it is in, Paris and London and Birmingham. But it's happened. And I think that until somehow the Saudis are threatened by the United States as far as cutting off military support, sanctions, they won't learn. And that's
Hassan,
the only way the Saudis will ever learn.
I get it. It's such an excellent point. I really appreciate your call. Peter Newman, speak to that, the Saudi Arabia piece of this.
So there are a couple of things here. The first is, the Saudi government is not supporting ISIS. You often hear that in the news, and there's no evidence of the Saudi state ever giving direct contributions to ISIS. Within Saudi Arabia, there may be people, powerful princes, who have given money indirectly to ISIS and to other extremist groups in Saudi. But the bigger point, I think, that your speaker was speaking to was the sort of religious doctrine that Saudi is advocating and spreading around the world. That is a doctrine that is typically called Salafism, Wahhabism, and that is a very rigid, intolerant doctrine of which the jihadists who are part of ISIS are arguably a fringe. So if Wahhabism is a fringe, then the ISIS people are the fringe of the fringe. Mm. And to some extent, I can see the point where people say that the spreading of Salafism and Wahhabism is indirectly promoting ISIS. I can, sympathize with that point. Mm.
Patrick Skinner, weigh in here. It's such an interesting point Hassan brings up about Saudi Arabia. How do you see it?
I agree with Peter. The Saudi government is not supporting ISIS. Now, of course, individuals do, but that happens in America, too. And so you can't use a broad brush. But they kind of belatedly started to crack down on people traveling there. The king gave a pretty remarkable speech on August 1st. Denouncing ISIS by name. I mean, the king usually might give a proclamation, but he gave a speech. And so he put himself out there, which is pretty remarkable for the king of Saudi Arabia. And so they've belatedly come to realize that, even though they were not supporting ISIS, they have kind of encouraged this sectarian chess match and this bloody battle in the region.
Absolutely.
They're using proxies against Iran. And so both Iran and Saudi hopefully are understanding, wow, this is getting out of control. They've tried to leverage violent proxies against each other, and now they have a good possibility of turning on them. So I think in the last several months, there's been a ratcheting back of public rhetoric, and they're cracking down on people traveling there. The imams are not allowed to openly support violent extremism anymore. So it's a subtle difference, but it's important.
Mm. Stephen is calling from Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, I just want to talk about the Zainayev brothers, but this ISIS, you know, I think the Middle East the last 10 years has gotten a really bad rap. There's a reason why they're legendary for hospitality. The Middle East is a big place, and it's legendary for hospitality. There's a reason why they call it the Ramada Inn. Now, as far as ISIS, it's their land. It's their place, you know, and we know how to take down organizations from Hamburg that flew out of Boston. Now what about self-radicals? What about the Zainayev brothers? Now,
Stephen, I hear it, and I'm going to move on to the next call because I want to get Dan in here from Cromwell, Connecticut. Hi, Dan. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, yeah, this is Dan Antiochus, RenegadeBroadcasting.com. My question is, with the shifting geopolitical alliances, more particularly this new Cold War we're seeing revved up by the media with Russia, it just seems that the West is spiritually and culturally dead, and with the triumph of plutocratic capitalism in World War II, we have nothing but materialism and decadence. So the elephant in the room is Israel. And I just don't understand, how is this going to fit in with Hamas or Hezbollah, Iran, and what's going on right now with, you know, Russia and the Ukraine? Are we looking at World War III, all because of this parasitic domination over our country? And that's really all I have.
All right, Dan, thank you. Peter Newman, put this into big geopolitical perspective for us.
I think this is possibly the one conflict that you cannot blame Israel for. I mean, by no possible means. This is a conflict that has arisen from, as a consequence of the Syrian uprising, as a consequence of the Arab Spring. It has spread into Iraq. It is something that Israel has actually been very quiet on, because from Israel's point of view, there are no good options here. They don't particularly like Bashar Assad. They don't like ISIS. All of them hate Israel. There's no good outcome from Israel's point of view. If they support Bashar Assad, they are empowering Hezbollah, who hates Israel. If they support ISIS or some of the extremists, they are empowering extremists who hate Israel. So from Israel's point of view, there's no good outcome. This is one conflict where you can safely say Israel has not had a hand in creating this conflict or influencing it.
Patrick Skinner, how does the presence of foreigners and Westerners affect ISIS as a whole? How does it change their dynamic and or their operations, would you say?
I think it does two things immediately. One, converts and foreign converts, extremists, are usually hyper-violent. They're like gasoline on a fire. So they're going to come in, they're going to try to make a name for themselves, like the so-called Beatles, the British trio that was suspected in Foley's murder. And so they come in, they're very, very, very violent, and they, maybe because of a language barrier, they're going to be contained with themselves, and they're just going to feed off each other, and it's going to be a feedback loop of violence. And then it attracts other people from that culture or from that language. The Foley video was a direct appeal to Westerners. I mean, they said, you know, the U.S. and the West. It was spoken in British dialect, so that there's no mistake who they want to listen to that. And if only, you know, 0.001% of the people that see that are attracted to it, that's still a significant amount of people. And then from the other hand, it gives ISIS an international flavor. It becomes a regional jihadist or insurgent now movement. And as they gain more and more followers in different places, that's where the real danger is, because these people don't have to get on a plane. They're already here. And so the susceptible population, that's why you can't have a civil war for 3 years in the middle of the Middle East, drawing in fighters, because eventually you don't have to go to Syria and fight. You can just pick the fight where you are. And that's what makes the international appeal so dangerous.
Humira Khan, jump in here. These hyper-converts, is that what you're seeing in the young people that you work with in the communities throughout this country, trying to prevent radicalization and counter these violent extremists?
We definitely see converts as part of the milieu of people who are engaged or who are starting, you know, who are committed to ideas or the behaviors, but they are not the only ones. In fact, within the U.S., the percentage of converts who have been involved in violent extremism has been roughly the same percentage of converts which exist in the Muslim population as a whole. So whereas there might be a few cases where it seems to be higher, but we are seeing approximately the same breakdown. So people who have been targeted are just as likely to be people who have grown up culturally Muslim or those who have converted. Mm. Now, in terms of the violence, that's a whole different thing, because what we're also seeing is not just converts who might be hyper-violent, but also people who are coming from cultural backgrounds and they have suddenly discovered ideology. Mm. And now they're trying to prove, or they're trying to, in some way, they think they're trying to wipe out all the bad stuff that they might have done in the past by going down this path. And since they've been completely convinced that what they're doing is correct, even though it is completely wrong, they feel it as a way of sort of cleansing themselves. So people coming from various backgrounds, but, you know, including converts, are going through this process of, okay, if we didn't, you know, because several of them have criminal backgrounds, they've been engaged in various types of, like, social ills before. And now that they want to actually, like, just become, we are the best. And somehow this process of violence and killing people, they feel is justifying cleansing themselves.
Peter Newman, how big of a threat to that point are foreign fighters? How big of a threat do they pose to the countries they come from?
Yes, and relating to what was said before, it's certainly true that the Western foreign fighters are often the most ideologically motivated. When me and my research team, we went down to the region, we interviewed a lot of fighters on the border between Turkey and Syria. A lot of Syrians told us that they would refuse to carry out suicide bombings, beheadings, because they know that this is not part of the local Islam that has been practiced in Syria for the past 1,000 years. But foreigners will do that sort of thing because they're purely ideologically motivated. They do not blend in. Often they do not speak Arabic. And you can use them for that sort of operation, which makes it attractive for ISIS. In terms of them returning, the only rigorous, credible study that has been carried out has shown that about 1 in 8 of the foreign fighters who are returning from foreign conflicts subsequently become involved in domestic acts of terrorism, which is still a sizable number if you consider how many people have gone to Syria.
Mm. Patrick Skinner, weigh in on that. 1 in 8 returning home to act as sleepers or outright terrorists. That's still something, right?
Yeah, I'm not good at math, but that's a pretty disturbing number because, if 1% goes out of 400, you're still talking 19 people to stabilize the globe in 9/11, of course, and the reactions. And so it doesn't take a lot of people, especially if they are battle-hardened, completely committed in what they believe in, and have the technical skills. And if all that's missing is maybe a charismatic leader in that area, and then you can have a cell start, much as like Jamaah Islamiyah in Indonesia. And that becomes a real problem. Then it becomes rooted inside that home community, and it's very difficult to get out.
Here's Musa in Austin, Texas. I'm glad you waited. Thanks for calling, Musa. Go ahead.
Hi. My comment in all this is this is my first time trying to put these things together. The problem in the Arab countries usually have been poses wrongly, and if you put a wrong question, you cannot have a right answer to the wrong question. You always will have a right, a wrong answer.
So what is the right question, Musa? I'm running out of time here. What is the right question?
The right question is that, is this an Islamic problem or a cultural problem? The Arabic, if you look at the Arabic countries from all those Persian and all the stuff, before the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, the society was as such corrupt and was so bad that the Prophet was born there to try to put people on the rail, on the right path.
I want to get your question answered, so I'm going to jump in, Musa. I apologize to interrupt you, but we're running out of time. Peter Newman, is this an Islamic problem or a cultural problem?
I think it's the problem of a fringe of the fringe of Islam, and it's also a problem of a major confrontation going on right now across the Middle East. It is the upheaval of the Arab Spring. It is the confrontation between Shiites and Sunnis, and all of this is coming together right now, which is a really unfortunate situation.
Peter Skinner, I'll give you the last word. Do you see this as an Islamic problem or a cultural problem?
No, I don't think it has anything to do with Islam. Islam is the medium or the vehicle that the extremists are going to use for appeal and justification. But it's a long-rooted problem in despair, dictatorship, and now sudden revolution. And there's chaos. And in chaos, the violent will usually win out in the short term until the moderates can kind of unify. And so it's it has nothing to do with Islam. These people are neither Islamic nor are they a state, but they are becoming accepted as that, at least in the nomenclature. And so it's really important that something be done.
Humaira Khan, I'll leave you with the last word, actually. Are you optimistic or more pessimistic in your view of where we're heading as far as these the counter of violent extremism?
Well, there's always hope, for sure. I think we'll actually, but to make sure that we can actually control the risk or bring it in, we will actually need to put in a lot more effort in terms of countering violent extremism. Because part of this, as has been mentioned earlier, is that there is an ideological aspect. And until we don't unapologetically deal with that aspect of it, especially for the Western foreign fighters, it's not going to go away. But we have to deal with long-term political, social, ideological, every aspect of it has to be dealt with.
Humaira Khan in Washington, Executive Director of Mufulhoon. Thank you so much for joining us, Humaira.
Thank you very much for having me.
Patrick Skinner is in Savannah, Georgia. He's Director of Special Projects for the Soufan Group. Patrick, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Peter Newman in London, Director of the International Center for the Study of Radicalization. Peter, great to have you. Thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you to Boston.
Listeners, you can join the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.